Well, as most of you know, Brittany went down to Panama in part to help women start businesses by teaching them economic principles. And she discovered that the situation was a little different than she had been told and had imagined, because instead of women who wanted to start businesses, she basically found an orphanage run by 15-year-old single moms who are not necessarily in the best position to be learning about interest rates and compound interest and other things like that. In fact, they don't have a whole lot of anything. And as we've talked and corresponded, I've kind of thought through, you know, what are some of the stuff that could help her. About 6 or 7 years ago, I was recruited to put together a curriculum for nonprofit organizations in Patterson, because they got grants, but they couldn't keep them. So community college and some of the religious leaders who were running much of the nonprofit world basically said, we need some stuff to help us manage the stuff so we can keep the grants, because they keep getting them and getting taken away because they can't perform. Unfortunately, they never pegged attendance to getting the grants. So as a result, you know, people didn't show up and they kept losing the grants. But as I went through all those principles that would be useful for a nonprofit institution, I basically came up empty in terms of what would be helpful or useful for Brittany in trying to minister to these folks. And I started doing been doing some research, and I tried to come up with a set of principles that would help her impart a biblical value system to folks, so that would help move them from a position of being economically dependent to economically independent. And in the process, I sent out some emails to some folks that I knew down in Panama that were kind of on the ground and knew what was going on, and got some helpful feedback from them. And I kind of searched through, cursorily, of course, all the current literature on best practices for orphans. And I realized none of this stuff works. You know, it's no surprise that they're in this condition. I kind of first had my attention drawn to the plight of orphans when I read George Mueller's book. And he started orphanages just to show that God answered prayer. And I've come across, you know, read of people who are still continuing to work in the orphanages, and the fact that they still needed folks to do that. And I'd read about Mother Teresa's work in India, and also of the fact that after all these years of operation, they still need people to help. And I'm thinking, something's wrong here. If you basically have ministered to orphans and got them onto their feet, one of the principles you should be teaching them is to requite, to pay back and help others. So an orphanage should be a self-sustaining organization after at least one generation. But the fact is that this doesn't happen. And people just don't have the right value system that gets communicated. So I spent some time the past couple weeks noodling on what kind of things would be useful and helpful to impart and ingrain in people's thinking. And I discovered, lo and behold, that the same thing you would teach an orphan or an unwed 15-year-old mom is the stuff that we as believers kind of need to follow as well. I remember my first year of reading the Bible, I came across this passage in James that said, pure and undefiled religion before God and the Father is this: to visit orphans and widows in their trouble and to keep oneself unspotted from the world. And immediately, because I have a quirky mind, the way I thought of it is, you know, going to go visit them and have tea with them. You know, what's the point of that? And then I started thinking a little bit more on this verse and thought, you know, why would this be like almost a definition of pure and undefiled religion? You know, what's this got to do with the price of tea in China and the Christian life? It just doesn't seem to fit. But then I realized that in this verse has some of the major truths of Christianity and Judaism as well, but you have to dig a little deeper to see them. One of them is other-centeredness. And in order to be able to give yourself to others without getting anything in return is a very Christ-like kind of thing to do. And then another piece that came up on reflection is this is equivalent to having on our heart what's on God's heart. And that's another essential element of Christianity. God's agenda is our agenda, and that's going to be reflected in this passage and the next. And of course, keeping yourself unspotted from the world goes without saying. But back in Deuteronomy, in the Old Testament, there's a passage that I have to admit I frequently skip over, you know, just skim through as I'm reading, because it doesn't seem as applicable. But because I was talking, looking at what the scriptures had to say about orphans and widows and that, those kind of folks, I spent a little more time on it and got correspondingly blessed. In Deuteronomy 26:13, Moses instructs the nation of Israel, just before they take up residence in the promised land, "Then you shall say before the Lord your God, I have removed the holy tithe from my house." So every 3 years or so, you have to take up 10% of what you earned and distribute it according to God's purpose. And so he's basically saying, I've done this. "I have also given them to the Levite, the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow, according to all your commandments which you have commanded me." So the Israelite is supposed to look back on what he has done and say, I have done what God commanded me. I've taken of mine, which God gave me, and I have distributed to others according to his commands. "I have not transgressed your commands, nor have I forgotten them." Then he's able to pray, "Look down from your holy habitation from heaven, O Lord, and bless." And then he gives an aside, "God commands you to observe these statutes. Therefore, you shall be careful to observe them with all your heart and with all your soul." The basic of getting blessed is doing what God wanted. And doing what God wanted was not something that we did as a, you know, hobby, but it's something that we did with all our heart and with all our soul. And much of Christianity kind of views like, oh, obeying God, that's just kind of, you know, if it's convenient, if it's not too hard, if you can do it, you know, it's not really that important. But the mindset of the Old Testament is also reflected in the New, if you read it, that we're supposed to be careful to do what God has said with all our heart and with all our soul. So widows and orphans fit in as just a subset of all the stuff that we're supposed to be doing. The command is repeated. And the reason it's repeated is because in order to minister to others, you have to draw upon God's grace, and it helps make us more dependent upon him. And you know, he kind of knows what he's doing when he tells us to do stuff. So I'm there thinking, what do you do with a house full of people that have no parents? Well, maybe some of the single moms are parents, who have obvious issues. This orphanage, fortunately, was founded by a church, so it's got more going for it than a lot of the other orphan programs. What is it that you can have to do to take people from being in a position where they are, you can just kind of imagine it, to being a productive, other-serving member of society? I went through some material on World Vision that kind of gave little excerpts of life in the Caribbean, El Salvador and Costa Rica particularly, of what life is like for some kids. And it was under a set of getting rid of child labor, which might not be a good idea. But they said the kids would wake up at 4 a.m. to hike 2 miles to the sugarcane fields to spend the next 6 or 7 hours chopping sugarcane with a machete. These are kids who are 11 years old. And then they would get rice and tortilla. And for this labor, they would get $1, maybe $2, depending on how many sugarcanes they hacked out. 10% of the people in the environment live on less than $1 a day. And I thought that only happened in Asia. But it's amazing that that's just a little to our south. And 44% of the people live below poverty level, whatever that means, because that's also a relative thing. But these kids are laboring, they don't get a chance to go to school, and some of the mentality is, well, they have a right to education, and one of the things is that they have a right to recreation. And I'm thinking, wow, if you compare these kids who are by choice working so they can contribute to their house to kids who have no parents whatsoever, their situation really doesn't look that bad. But what about a group of kids who grow up in an orphanage, who don't really get an education? What is their future? What's going to happen to them? Unless they start thinking differently, they're going to wind up, and their kids are going to wind up in the same situation where they started. Something has to change. So normally the first way you work on fixing a problem is understand how it was caused, and that kind of came up with the first biblical principle. Basically, you reap what you sow. It's one of the things that has to be communicated. And this actually gives people a vision. People who are trapped in various difficult situations kind of need a vision and a way out. And one of the best ways to get out is to understand how you got in. Because if you take people and just pull them out of the situation that they're in, guess where they wind up? Back in the same situation. I was amazed, as I was looking at the efficacy of much of the foreign aid that's been given, how much of it just doesn't work. And as well, you debate parents know, a lot of the stuff that gets distributed as foreign aid doesn't work either. A couple $100 million were given in 2007 for microfinance loans. And now they're saying, we need more. Why? Because it didn't work. So if it didn't work, we just give them more of it and then see it not work even better. So you need to understand that we reap what we sow. We inevitably become the product of our thinking, choices, and actions. So at first it's going to sound like bad news, but it's actually really good news. And one of the principles I'm fond of advocating for the Christian life is if you don't like radishes, plant strawberries. Because if you're planting radishes, that's all you're going to get. You have to plant the right things, the right thoughts, in order to get the right responses. I came across a version that I thought was appropriate. It's called the New Century Version. It's kind of written for a third grade level, so we should be able to understand it. In Galatians 6:7, it says, "Do not be fooled. You cannot cheat God. People harvest only what they plant. If they plant to satisfy their sinful selves will bring them ruin." It's like a law of life. But if they plant to please the Spirit, they will receive eternal life from the Spirit. And then, we must not become tired in doing good. We will receive our harvest of eternal life at the right time if we do not give up. So, when we have opportunity to help anyone, we should do it. But we should give special attention to those who are in the family of believers. A question that I think is appropriate to ask in light of this principle is, which of our undesirable circumstances are consequences of our actions? For us, just about all of them. And for these kids, if you think about an orphan, are they there because of their actions? No, they're there because of the undesirable actions of others. And people need to understand that certain actions are undesirable so they don't get repeated. Because what happens is you tend to repeat whatever you've seen. And we tend to not talk about, well, how did you get in this situation? Oh, let's not talk about that. No, no, we need to talk about how you get in the situation so you don't stay in the same situation. And then a good question for thought is, you know, what could we do to change and get a better harvest? I don't like what I have. I can change by planting something different and eventually get there. So the first principle is we reap what we sow. And that is not a common thought in our culture. And I suspect it's not a common thought in your culture either. You don't need a dollar to dream. You need to plant strawberries if you want to get strawberries. The second one, principle that I think needs to be imparted, is we have to have a priority of pleasing God if we want to be blessed by Him. And in a situation like this, particularly an orphan, you need God's blessing. You need His protection. You need Him to give you pleasure. You need Him to give you prosperity. I was doing some research on giftedness, because that's the next topic coming up, and I came across a guy who was about 14 years old, had won a scholarship to Oxford. Couldn't even go for a number of years. He could listen to poetry and recite it perfectly, word for word. He had a little more trouble with prose, but eventually he could actually just read something, and if he was engaged, he would remember it perfectly. He, at the age of 14 or 15, figured out that giftedness was a hindrance. Because giftedness prevented you from developing your will, and your will was the key to success. You never heard of this guy, but you would think someone who at the age of 14 had figured that out, who had such an intellect, would be awesome. But also around the age of 14, someone said to him, "Who made God?" And that just totally overthrew his faith in God. And he went about using all his talents for a self-serving life. And the funny thing is, everything he touched, he started out turning into a success, and it became a failure. You know, it's like, yeah, got into cattle rustling, and the Chicago Fire destroyed it. And I kind of realized, you know, it looks like God is actively working against him to prevent him from realizing the natural fruit of his talents. Awesome talents! I mean, it's like I was thinking when I first started reading about him that, wow, you know, how come I haven't heard of this guy? And I just realized he didn't have a priority of pleasing God. He had a priority of pleasing himself, and everything fell apart. The flip side of that is if your priority is of pleasing God, even, you know, people of meager abilities can do really well. In fact, if you want riches and honor in life, please God. Proverbs 22:4. Wisest man Solomon said, it's by humility and the fear of the Lord that we get riches, honor, and life. And humility has upon it the concept of dependence upon God. A little earlier in Proverbs, it said in 13:23, the poor man's field may produce much, but injustice sweeps it away. And I realized, you know, even if you could take an orphan and instill them with all the values and education and everything else, there is still a need for God, because there are greater societal injustices that can sweep things away. And the only way you get to keep the stuff is if God chooses to let you have it. Otherwise, you can work on reforming all of society, and we all kind of know that doesn't work real well. So the second principle is you have to have a priority of pleasing God. Now, God is the father to the fatherless, Psalm 68:5 says, the defender of widows, is God in his holy dwelling. And in Matthew 6:9, we're taught to pray to our Father who is in heaven. And the idea that you need a father for guidance and protection is another reason for wanting to please him. But Solomon also, after he had everything and reflected on all that he'd done, came to this conclusion, which he repeats numerous times in Ecclesiastes 2:24. And again, I think I took this out of the New Century Version. The best that people can do is eat, drink, and enjoy their work. But I saw that even this, the ability to enjoy stuff, comes from God. Because no one can eat or enjoy life without him. If people please God, God will give them wisdom, knowledge, and joy. But sinners, they will only get the work of gathering and storing up wealth that they'll have to give to the ones who please God. So all their work is useless, like chasing the wind. You never quite catch it. Most of your versions say vanity, meaningless, vapor. So if you want to be able to enjoy the blessings of life, you have to first and foremost please God. You have to fear him, care about what he thinks, and let that be your guiding star. And then everything else comes, including the protection and pleasure of this life. The question I ask under Roman numeral 2 is, you know, what's the result of pleasing ourselves or others rather than God? Well, if you work on pleasing others, you give away all your stuff, and then they turn somewhere else, and you're left without having gotten there anything. And plus, you lost all your stuff. If you work on pleasing yourself, you consume all your stuff, and you find out it doesn't satisfy. The result of pleasing ourselves and others rather than pleasing God is vanity. It's meaningless. It's like chasing after the wind. Corollary to this is, well, how do you actually please God? And, of course, Colossians 1, you got a bunch of stuff there. But its basic root is you find out what he likes and you give it to him. It's that simple. Find out what he likes and gives it to him. So, you know, someone came up to me and said, you know, Bill, I got you some chicken livers with green peppers. Oh, thank you. How did you know? It's just what I hate. You think about what people offer God. I mean, it's like, ah. Oh. Poor God, he's always getting stuff he doesn't like. But he actually goes on record and telling him, this is what I like, this is what I want you to do, do it, and we'll both be happy. So one of the values that I think Brittany needs to inculcate in the people's thinking is pleasing God is crucial. Of course, having a relationship with him would be part of that. Because regardless of how well you can do, if you don't have God watching out for you, you don't have God protecting you, you're going to be disappointed. But if you have God pleasing you, regardless of what happens, you'll be happy. The third principle is one that applies to us as well, is character counts. And I've done some sermons on character recently, and basically character is defined by the value choices we make. It's choosing to do stuff that we naturally do. It's choosing to do stuff that we wouldn't normally prefer. It's what marks us most, and it's called character. And some of the character traits that I thought would be particularly useful are honesty, integrity, trustworthiness, diligence, faithfulness, patience, and perseverance. And these are things that have all stood each of you well in your quest for success at work and also in life. One of the acquaintances I've developed a little bit of a relationship with in Panama is a guy who used to be a guitarist for Purple Rain and Janis Joplin. In fact, he was one of the guys who wrote, "Lord, won't you give me a Mercedes-Benz?" after Janis came back with a Porsche. So three of the guys kind of sat down and kind of did this song as a joke. And most of you from our generation know the song. And the guy is now in Panama. He's a phenomenal guy. He's written like 93 books. He's does stuff. He's like was headed an auto salvage yard, and he had a hotel down there, and he actually has written a book on growing orchids from seeds, because he was a geneticist, botanist. You know, he's just a really interesting guy. So I was corresponding with him, and I asked him, he described Brittany's situation, I said, you know, what are some of your thoughts? Because he's seen the good, bad, and the ugly of paradise. And he said, among other things, and I'll probably mention a few other things later, you know, a cleaning service would be a really great thing to do, because these people, you know, it's limited skill set. If the people were honest, he says, you cannot teach people that they should not steal from their employers. And he says, the common problem is everyone has to watch the cleaning people, because they'll just take stuff from their employers and think that they can continue to have a job. Basic honesty keeps people out of trouble. And enable, it's like you can develop, think about it, you can develop a great reputation just by being honest. And that's one of those things that needs to be taught, character. And I thought of a guy called Joseph. Most of you know he occupies the bulk of the book of Genesis, which is really significant because a lot of ink stop and think. Why do we have more about Joseph than we do about Abraham? You know, there's like huge lessons to be had in Joseph's life. And one of the themes that gets repeated in Joseph's life is he continues to make the best of a bad situation. Never gets bitter, never gets discouraged, always has the perspective, which he finds out in chapter 50, that, you know, people may mean things for evil, but God means it for good. It's 50-20 at the end. But you know the story where Joseph gets sold by his brothers into slavery because they're jealous of him. He goes to a guy called Potiphar, who buys him, an Egyptian kind of guy. And when Potiphar in 39:3 saw that the Lord was with Joseph, and that the Lord made Joseph successful in everything he did, he basically hires him and was very happy with him. And the major piece, the scriptures don't really give us a really defining verse on Joseph until chapter 50, verse 20. Is that the Lord was with him. You know, Daniel, right in the front of the book, you got Daniel purposed in his heart, he would not defile himself. And then that works out through the book. But Joseph, you don't get a nice little phrase like that, at least I didn't recall or see one. But you do get the phrase that the Lord was with him, and it was obvious. And I think the only reason you have that is because he followed number two, priority of pleasing God. So there the Lord's with Joseph. Joseph gets made head over everything. His employer is happy with Joseph. He put Joseph in charge of the house. He entrusted him with everything he owned. And the Lord blessed people in Potiphar's house because of Joseph. The Lord blessed everything that belonged to Potiphar, both in the house and in the field, just because of Joseph. Joseph had such a relationship with pleasing God that God not only blessed Joseph, but everyone connected with him. You also know the story that, you know, Joseph's wife also was pretty pleased with Joseph. I mean, Potiphar's wife was pleased with Joseph, and that didn't work out very well because Joseph was going to be pure. So he gets thrown into prison. In prison, unjustly, totally wrong, Joseph actually winds up being put in charge of all the other prisoners because the Lord was with him. And then he gets put in Pharaoh's house. And what happens? Joseph gets put in charge of everything else. So if a person has the right relationship with God, God will cause them to prosper far, far more than their natural talents would warrant. A couple of verses from Proverbs. It's interesting, I was talking to my boys about this, and they mentioned the anti-capitalist bias that many places have. So I kind of just want to do a little quick survey of, you know, what did the Bible say about riches? And you just type in riches in an online Bible search program, limit it to Proverbs, and you'll get a couple dozen verses over that on riches and Proverbs. You know, humility and fear of the Lord, riches, honor and life. But here's a really good practical one. 28:6. It is better to be poor and live right than to be rich and dishonest. That's from the CEV, American Bible Society. It's better to be poor and live right than to be rich and dishonest. I'm sure that many Latin American countries, including ours, much of the rich are dishonest, kind of how you get there. Of course, there are people who got there by hard work, diligence, pleasing God, and all that other good stuff. But in a lot of countries where the rule of law is not that manifest, riches are acquired through dishonesty. And what we have in verse 28:6 is a value decision. Is it, which is better? You want to be poor or you want to be rich? Well, most of us say we want to be rich. Okay, yeah, that's good. Now, do you want to be rich and a little dishonest, or do you want to be poor living righteously? And that's where it gets tough. If you basically say you want to live right or you want to be dishonest, oh, I want to live right. Okay, but now when you get this little conflict, which is more important to you? Well, Solomon, wise guy, under the influence of the Holy Spirit, says it's better to have the value of being poor and right, of losing your job, of even being persecuted, than to compromise on what's right in order to gain riches. Proverbs 22:1, a good name is to be chosen rather than great riches. I see so clearly that values are a choice. Which do you pick? And you basically pick your values based on which gives you the better return. We all operate on that. And I'm not advocating we abandon that. What I advocate is that we basically say, do we want to be doing better now or in the future? Do we want to be doing better by temporal standards or by eternal standards? That's what character is all about, making the right value choices in light of the right time standard. Question. How can you cultivate the character traits that God blesses? Character is not automatic. And the role of Proverbs, you know, Proverbs tells you, this is good, this is bad. Choose the good, good things will happen. And just spending time having that be your value system, I think is a major way to develop character. Of course, I have a couple outlines on it you can look up on your own. So you get a vision, you're going to reap what you sow, and hopefully you start thinking, okay, I want to do things differently. And the first top on that list is I want to be pleasing to God. And then I want to have a character that is also pleasing to God, which is going to be beneficial to others. Now what? Then you get to kind of the fun, more economic stuff. If you don't have those first three principles down, anything else is just going to probably backfire. Principle number four, God uses what we have and place at his disposal to enable us to profitably serve the needs of others. And the story that I picked to illustrate this is when a little kid with the tuna fish sandwiches when in Matthew 14, 17, people are following and disciples come up to Jesus and say, hey, we don't have anything to eat. Jesus basically says to them, what do you have? And they said to him, we have here only 5 loaves and 2 fish. And Jesus said, bring them to me. And if you kind of drifted off and you kept reading a couple phrases later, you would say, so 5,000 people got fed, and they gathered up 12 baskets of fragments. So how many disciples were there? 12. So each has got this huge basket of fragments. And, you know, why did God have them gather them up? You know, it's a lesson for the disciples that he can provide. But how did he do this miracle? Well, he did it with what they had. And that's the way I think God frequently works. He takes what we have and he multiplies it and uses it. So you kind of need to do an inventory of what do we have? And then you need to place it at God's disposal and say, God, I dedicate this for your purposes. Use it. I had a friend, actually used to be an intern here at Big Apple Chapel, and eventually went getting his doctorate and going on to set up a leadership institute in Albania right after they were the last country to give up atheism as its official religion of the state. And we were dialoguing back then, and he was saying, you know, how do you help these people? You know, here they've been under this atheistic, communistic rule, they have nothing. And my response to him was, well, you got to start with what do they have? Do they have a piece of land? Do they have a pleasant piece of land? If it's just a piece of land, they got to grow something on it. If it's a pleasant piece of land, you can do tourism on it. You have to take what you have and figure out how you can use that to benefit or serve others. For those of you who've been through any of my stuff on work, you realize work consists of service. You're serving the needs of others. And that's why being a servant is a great idea. It's a Christ-like thing as well, and God rewards it. But you think about, what do we have that we can use to serve others? And my friend down in Panama said, you know, people here are good at chicken, but everybody gets tired of chicken. He said, what we want is some real, and he gave me this name I had to look up, and it was a name for sausage. And he said, if people could just make the sausage, sell it on the streets, it could develop into a restaurant, and if they gave people what they something different, which is what they would really want. If you just give them what everybody else gives them, you're not going to distinguish yourself. And all of you guys know anything about branding and marketing, you have to give people something that they want that's going to satisfy their need for variety and that kind of stuff. He said another thing is, you know, there's really nobody who sews any stuff around here. And one of the reasons the whole tailor business has gone out is because of American foreign aid, particularly in Africa. A whole generation does not know how to sew, because all these church groups would bundle up clothes and t-shirts and ship them over for foreign aid. And they put all the tailors out of work, because how do you compete with a free t-shirt? So he says, now there's an entire generation of Tanzanians who don't know how to sew because of well-meant intention but ill-guided American foreign aid. But they have a similar situation in Panama where, you know, the basic service industries, they're wide open. They require a whole lot of skill. It's not a high trade thing, but it's something that could be taught to people. And as long as you don't take the clothes that are given to you to sew, you give them actually back to the person. We have the basis of a real business going on. What do you have, and how can you place it at his disposal? That's a really good principle for us, too, as we think about ourselves at work. You know, what do we have to be able to serve others? We have skills, we have talents. We need to put them at God's disposal. And the neat thing is, God is at work in us to kind of prompt us in doing that. Philippians 4:13, it's God who works in you, both to will and to do his good pleasure. And the very next verse, I thought was very, very appropriate for the whole workplace environment. We talked about this just a couple weeks ago. Do all things without complaining and disputing or grumbling. So God's at work in you to serve the needs of others. You do it without complaining and disputing. Hey, I'd want to hire people like that, wouldn't you? Of course, a little level of competence would be nice as well. And a verse that underscores this, Matthew 10:45. Some people think that serving others is beneath them. If you ever think that service is beneath you, there's this guy called Jesus. One of his favorite titles for himself was the Son of Man. And he who basically should be served by all came not to be served, but to serve and give his life a ransom for many. So the model of service is well rooted in Christian thought. Question for this: what has God given you that you could use to serve the needs of others and benefit them? How can you increase your capacity for service? I didn't have a great verse for this, but one of the thoughts is if you want to increase your returns, increase your service. And if you want to increase your service, you increase your capacity to service. This is why a lot of people get an education, so they can serve others. You are more valuable to an employer if you learn stuff. I, as an educator, think education is way overrated. Way overrated, and those of you who have hired educated people also recognize, yeah, it's not. The basics of reading, writing, and comprehension. I would much rather have a person who is self-taught than a person who has been, you know, basically has a certificate said, I sat in a classroom for so many hours. A person who is inquisitive about their world, who's going to learn through all their life, is the kind of person who's going to be able to render increased service to others. You know, it's astounding, the number of people who, once they finish college, never read a book again. It's huge. It's like 80% of people never read a book again. It's bizarre. So if you want to increase your capacity for service, you need to learn how to do that. Okay, Roman numeral 5. It's God's will that we work. Who knew? Work. Look it up in the dictionary. It talks about doing something that's hard. With diligence, that's the word I just chose to highlight here, wholeheartedness, observant initiative, and faithfulness. Colossians 3:23. Whatever you do, do your work heartily. Heartily. Wholeheartedness. Got those two confused. As if you're serving the Lord rather than serving men. Because you know that from the Lord you'll receive your reward, which is the inheritance. It's the Lord Christ whom you serve. Work is service. And work is supposed to be done for an employer as if you were serving the Lord. Yeah, just do it. Do it with wholeheartedness. Do it diligently. Proverbs 10:14. He who has a lazy hand becomes poor, but the hand of the diligent makes rich. Diligence. You do it until it's done. It's a component of faithfulness. It's amazing how frequently diligence is a precious possession of a person. It's, you know, it's the thing that gets you the blessings that you seek. We're also in the spiritual life commanded to be diligent to add to our faith certain things. In 2 Peter chapter 1, a lot of you are familiar with that passage. Diligence is key. And one of the pieces I also threw with this is observant initiative. People who can, you know, do what they're supposed to do, take the initiative to do additional stuff, are the people who eventually rule. It's pretty simple. The question I ask under this is, how can you keep motivated to be diligent and work in tough situations? Because, you know, we're finite. We get tired. We want to quit. What is it that causes you to persevere and be diligent? I think most of us would have to admit it's we want someone to notice. You know, if I quit now, people will say I'm a quitter. I don't want to be called a quitter. And we're diligent because we want to be noticed. But how do you keep yourself motivated if no one notices? If no one says, good job. If no one says, wow, you worked really hard on that. Well, you go back to Colossians 3, which is going to go back to Roman numeral 2. You do it to please God. And if you do your work as worship for the pleasing of God and draw upon God's resources to get the thing done, you'll accomplish it. Some of you might remember we had a former president named Richard Nixon who said in one of his biographical statements that, you know, he really wasn't smarter than those around him, and that kind of got borne out in part by history. But he would just keep at tasks longer. He said they used to call him when he was in the military lead bottom, because he would just sit in the chair until he got the task done. And that's a great task, particularly for us peas to think about. It's, you do it until it's done, and you don't stop until it's done. Jays, you have less trouble with that. The problem with Jays is they sometimes don't do the right tasks. But, but they will do it until it's done, right or wrong. And then there's the observant pee who says, you know, I might be doing the wrong test, so I better not, you know, I'm not sure everyone really to do it right, because it might be wrong. You know, but diligence is a precious possession. It's something that's worth cultivating, and then cultivating a sensitivity to the Spirit of God so you do the right stuff along with His Word, and you'll be unstoppable. So it's God's will that we actually work with diligence. Therefore, we need to do it to please Him rather than others or ourselves. Two more. Simple and relatively self-explanatory. Teamwork and loyalty. Ecclesiastes 4:9, also out of the NCB. Two people are better than one because they get more done by working together. Notice it doesn't say talking together. By working together. One falls down, the other can help him up. But it is bad for the person who is all alone and falls because no one is there to help. As I thought about these kids in an orphanage, I thought, you know, the idea of teamwork, of being loyal and committed to each other, is really going to be the difference between some of them succeeding and not. Because it's so hard to keep on track, on point, all the time. But if you have someone else there to help you do that, then you're more likely to succeed. All of you have experienced the joy of another partner, roommate, accountability partner, friend, whatever, that helps you keep on track. And we kind of need that. God did not make us to be independent. And that comes from a guy who works really well independently. In fact, Chet was trying to help me with something, and basically I said, you know, let me think about this and I'll have to get back to you. It's just, you know, there are some tasks that are better done by yourself, but for the majority of people, knowing that you're part of a team and working together makes the thing happen. I was surprised when I kind of got out of college and I became aware of a little bit how the world works, how so much of sales was done by teams, and they would have sales meetings, and then I just realized this is just a team pep talk. You know, it's basically a group of people need to be accountable to the other people in the group to make the thing happen. So teamwork is key. The problem with teamwork, though, is how do you deal with the other person's sin? You know, because not only do the good benefits get multiplied, the bad things get multiplied as well. And the idea of keeping short accounts, keeping focused on the objective, can help that work. So what are the advantages and disadvantages of working with others? Advantages is they pull you along. Disadvantages, they also pull you down by doing the wrong thing. How should difficulties be resolved? By open, honest, and sensitive communication. And last but not least, stewardship. A lot of people I've noticed, and I like to read historical blogs and journals and, you know, get a sense of how life worked at different times. And people who are not writing necessarily for an audience, but just their honest reflections on life. And that way I get multiple lifetimes of experience and just my one little life, because I don't believe in reincarnation. And I notice frequently how people will come into resources and then just blow it. And, like, you know, the classic is, you know, cowboys on cattle drive. You know, and they get paid, and by the end of the next night, everything they got paid is gone. And, you know, then they have to sign up for the next cattle drive. Works great for the bosses, but, you know, why is it that so few people can keep the fruits of their labor? Well, there's a verse in, I think it's Halleck. It's like Haggai or Malachi, probably Haggai. That basically says you've sowed much and you reap little. You know, you put your money in pockets with holes in it and you just don't manage to keep it. It's basically because your priorities are wrong. God says, consider your ways. You got to put me first and then things will happen. But the thing that I think is the overarching principle that needs to be adopted by folks who want to become independent economic units is the principle of stewardship. And right underneath Roman numeral 7, I put in brackets two principles of stewardship. Principle number one is God owns it all. Principle number two is what does God want done with his stuff? That's it. Stewardship's really, really simple. It's God's. Now, how does God want me to use his stuff? Does he want me to give his stuff away to others indiscriminately? Or does he want me to give purposefully? Does he want me to use his stuff for, you know, just escape my escapism? Or does he want me to use his stuff for the benefit of the long range? So, proper biblical stewardship under Roman numeral 7 gives purposefully, spends wisely, saves faithfully, invests in the future, and requites or pays back. All those are elements of stewardship. If you gain, God's given you that gain for purposes. You need to figure out what his purposes are. How does God want you to use his stuff? And since Brittany might be using this outline, I thought I'd throw in this verse that gives a little flavor of it. 1 Timothy 5:3. Take care of the widows who are truly widows. But if a widow who has children or grandchildren, let them first learn to do their duty to their own family and to repay their parents or grandparents. That's a principle of requite, to pay back. It's one of those tasks that is specifically spelled out for kids to do. That pleases God. So paying back pleases God. So if people are inculcated with the value of pleasing God, then they should pay back. The true widow, who is all alone, puts her hope in God and continues to pray night and day for God's help. So someone who is all alone has God to call out to, and God provides help. That's what he does. He's the father of the fatherless. Someone who is a good steward will eventually be using proceeds of their blessings for God's purposes. Proverbs 28:20. A faithful man will abound with blessings. He who hastens to be rich will not go unpunished. Because basically you're going to short-circuit the character and pleasing God traits in order to get rich. Question for the thought is, how can you be a better steward of what you have? How can you invest in your future? And how can you say no to yourself and others? This guy who was really big on will, he said, you know, I really like bread, so I decided I wouldn't eat bread for a week. He said, I really like something else, so I decided I wasn't going to have it for a month. He said, I wasn't going to get drunk because I decided I was just going to be in control of myself. You know, just like amazing, amazing ability to say no to himself. That, like, I don't find that among most believers who supposedly have the Spirit of God at work in them. So if the Spirit of God is at work in you, to willing to do his good pleasure, he should be able to be directing you how he wants you to use his stuff. He should be able to directing you to say no to yourself. He should be able to be directing you how you should invest in others. So those are some principles that I think underscore economic freedom for all folks. You know, things like capital, division of labor, and entrepreneurship are really great for economic society development. But these principles should work independent of any culture or society, because it's basically pleasing God and having God work through you to accomplish his purposes in your life, which should result in prosperity one way or another. Okay, questions on what I said or additional thoughts would be more than welcome. Yeah?
So this group is fairly successful in the world, eyes of the world, relatively wealthy. What do you think the biggest pitfalls, potential pitfalls for people like us are?
Boy, Steve, good question. And I think that the warning that Moses gave, or God gave through Moses to the folks in Deuteronomy, is very, very applicable to us. It's like when you're prospered, you know, when you're doing well, when you've got all the good of the land, don't sit back and think, I'm really paraphrasing this, my own hand has gotten me this, and cease to be dependent upon God. Because it's God who gives the ability to do it. And yeah, God uses the abilities we have to get us, you know, where we are. But if that Roman numeral 2, the priority has got to be pleasing him. And I think our tendency is, you know, once we are no longer desperately needy, our response to God is, okay, God, next time we need you, we'll call. And I think, you know, what God does is he makes us desperately needy again. But sometimes he'll just say, all right, you insist on going your own way, I'll let you go your own way. And then, you know, people would lose. So the same danger that Israel had is the danger that we have of just becoming complacent. The question we've got to be asking is, what does God want us to do with his stuff? And his stuff is my life, our life. Not just, you know, finances, that's minor. But what does God want me to do? And if we take the stuff that God's given us and use it for ourselves, we not only misuse it, but we become bad stewards. And, well, stewards have to give an account to whom much is given, much is required. So Jill was actually made a comment. Yeah, that's in the context of knowledge and wisdom. You know, anybody who's got any of these outlines or heard my voice know that there's, you know, a lot of good biblical knowledge and wisdom. A lot of it. Much required. Much given, much required. One thought. Yeah, sir, hands.
Just to expand on that, my experience over life and interplaying with people has been that wealthy people feel that they're totally self-sufficient. They can buy almost anything they need. They don't have to depend on anything or anybody, and therefore run the risk of forgetting that there is even a God because they have no need for anything. So that the need for something sometimes can be a great blessing. Not that abject poverty is a blessing, but rather the absence of everything. And I think one of the things we forget when we read the Bible about how difficult it is for a rich man to enter heaven is that that rich person maybe is not an evil person per se, but has placed so much confidence and trust and has gained so much in life from that that they have no appreciation for God or anything else because they don't need anything else. And that's a horrible, horrible risk. Awful lot of people I know are in that position. It's kind of frightening. The other thing I'll mention is I've, over many years, have hired countless numbers of people. And I've fortunately only had to fire a few. And one of the things that I always said to people before I hired them was that if they weren't self-starters, not to even join with me, because I want nobody working for me who has to be told what to do. If they can't figure out what to do for themselves, and if they're not self-satisfied about what they're doing, then they shouldn't come to work. And I think it's a pretty good principle for the way we conduct ourselves in our actions. If we're not competitive, if we're not self-starters, if we don't really enjoy what we're doing, we're not going to be very valuable to God any more than we can be valuable to an employee. And that principle, having people who are self-starters, can save you from having to fire a lot of people in life because you never hire them in the first place. And many people are scared off when they hear that. So that's a good principle.
Yeah, very good. Totally echo both of those. A bit about no needs was even echoed by Jesus in the book of Revelation. People he wants to spew out of his mouth, the lukewarm thing, is because you say you have no needs. Bless you.
God uses what we have and places at his disposal to enable us to properly serve the needs of others. So I had once a conversation with a missionary, and he said he's grateful for people who work in corporations and places, you know, like we all work in, because God uses us to help the missionaries out in the field. Right? So it's easy to, you can see it, one falling into the trap of, it's easy to just, you know, you work in a corporation, you get the rugs there, you cut the check, and it's easy to cut that check, and you're helping all these people. How do you react to that?
God has a great response to that. He said, I own the cattle on 1,000 hills. Do I need a hamburger from you? Well, paraphrase on the second half of that.
Paraphrase.
Yeah. But, you know, it's like God's work done God's way never lacks God's resources. You know, God does not just have us as cash cows. He has us as his representatives in the spheres in which we live to do his work. So, you know, it's funny. I've done a lot of thinking over the years over what it costs to fund an American missionary or British going overseas versus a national. You know, it's like you could fund 10,000 national missionaries for the price of, you know, one American. It's just absurd. So, and the work, yeah, and basically they reproduce a brand of American Christianity that doesn't really take root because it's, you know, not indigenous. So that would be my response. Yeah.
Sorry.
Go for it.
One thing I forgot to mention is that, Fiona, in response to what you were saying earlier about looking for the praise of others. If you'll think about it for your own ambition in life and for your own progress in any field, whether it just be your employer or otherwise, as you move up the ladder, there are fewer and fewer people who can praise you. Now you reach the point that you're the boss, then who is there left to praise you? So if you're looking to progress or looking for your happiness from the praise of others, you can't rise very far in anything that you do. Similarly, I think God has that same motivation for us. So if you're not doing what you're doing for God's pleasure and appreciation, you're going to find that fewer and fewer people are going to appreciate what you're doing.
Good point. Yeah, Tito.
When I was married, during my marriage, 25 years, happily married with my wife, I never knew the pain of somebody losing his spouse until I lost mine. And now that it's been almost more than 2 years, I feel that I've sort of quote-unquote healed through the stages. But each time I see my son, I just feel so sorry that it's very, why did he was deprived of growing up with a mother, without a mother whom he loved so much more than anybody else. And to the point that sometimes I know it's wrong, but I just give everything he wants because he has no mother. And it's easier for a person who hasn't lost a spouse to say, oh, you're spoiling him or you're just being too tolerant. But once you lose a spouse, especially if you've been married more than 20 years, and you really love each other very well, it's very difficult to say that. And I tell my son, you know, and he knows, each time I give you money, I know you don't need it really, but I just want you to feel that I'm your mother and your father at this time. And it's difficult, but my son has been has healed already. He's still in the process of healing, but what I can say is when you are married and you have a spouse, love your spouse very, very dearly. Because when the time comes that God calls for either one of you to go, then you feel the pain of being a widow or a widow. People take for granted, oh, your wife just died, look for another one. Or, you know, like my younger brother, who's vice president of Toronto Bank in Canada, told me, you're very lucky your wife died. He was putting it in the context that with all the money you have right now, with all the wealth that you have right now, you can enjoy. You can go around the world and, you know, spend your money and spend time with all the kinds of girls that you like. I told my brother, you know, I told him, you've been married only for 15 years. The only thing I can tell you is love your spouse very dearly. Because when you lose him or lose her, it really hurts. It really hurts. And no matter how good your psychiatrist is, no matter how good your therapist is, nothing replaces a lost spouse. That's what I can say.
Okay, pizza's here. The 11th commandment is thou shalt not eat old pizza. So let's pray. Heavenly Father, thank you that you are Father to the fatherless. Thank you that you desire what is best for us. Thank you that your word contains principles that work in any situation, and that they are principles designed to bless us. Thank you that we can have access to them, we can follow them, your spirit works in us to cause it to happen. I pray for Brittany in her work that you would guide her in imparting truth to people that will change their lives permanently forever. And I thank you for our food and our fellowship. May it be pleasing in your sight. In Christ's name, amen.